There's always something new from our sponsor, Text Control. They just released version 30 of their document processing library that includes new document collaboration features. Using TX Text Control, you can integrate online document editing, document signing, collaboration, and PDF processing into your ASP.NET and ASP.NET Core web applications. Whether you need to create PDF invoices, quotations, or reports, TX Text Control provides the developer libraries for all document-related tasks. Check out the new features and see their technologies in action by visiting the live demo at demos.textcontrol.com. That's demos.textcontrol.com. Hi, I'm Scott Hansel, and this is another episode of Hansel Minutes. Today, I'm talking with Jordan Adler. He's the head of developer engineering at OneSignal, and he heads a number of open source projects and has a deep interest in code generation and code transformation, which is a subject after my own heart. So I'm pretty excited to talk with you today, Jordan.
I'm excited, too. I'm very passionate about code and code as data. There's a lot of really interesting ways to apply that kind of construct and knowledge. And to me, it's like compilers, but only the fun part.
Compilers, but only the fun part. Absolutely. Because I've been having conversations with early in career developers and trying to explain to them the difference between computer science and software engineering, and the, you know, the science underneath computers versus the practice of developing and shipping software. And code generation and code transformation and the all the things in between really has a foot in each side of that. You could look at it from multiple ways, but you're using code generation to make it easier to ship stuff. You're not just doing this for the science and the fun of it.
Not just making it easier to ship stuff, but to build new features that wouldn't be available otherwise in our tools and products, but also to do migrations, right? I mean, how many, you know, lift and shift kind of migrations have you done, certainly on these legacy code bases, which I don't know how I feel about the word legacy code base. Every code base is a legacy. But I think there's a really great set of techniques that you can use code generation and code transformation to that goes above and beyond kind of the compilers and transformers kind of stuff that we're, transpilers, the stuff that we're used to.
Do you think that code generation is one of those tools that you thought would have blown up and become 100% ubiquitous, but just never really popped? Because I feel like not enough people know about it, like know that this is a tool in their toolbox. It's not ubiquitous.
So I'm going to challenge you on that. I think it is ubiquitous. I think people are using it all the time without even knowing.
There it is.
And I think that if you have the chance to understand, like if you dig under the hood on some of these tools, you'll see that they're really using kind of code as data and metaprogramming principles. And the more that you understand that, the more you look behind the curtain, you'll find techniques that are used in some of the tools that you use on a daily basis that you can apply to your own program code.
Okay. So we are all upstream of these things and we're not realizing that they're being used for us. But should we familiarize ourselves with these tools? Like it's one thing to use a thing that uses code gen, but it's another to go and talk to my engineering manager and you say, you know, I think we should introduce a code generator into this at a higher level so that we all can benefit, you know, generating an SDK or something.
Absolutely. So, you know, thinking about ways in which we use them all the time, static analyzers kind of leverages some of the parsing and code as data constructs. You know, I'm talking code analysis tools that don't actually run the code. They just read them, like Roslyn in the kind of C# world, or RuboCop in the Ruby world, which looks, you know, for style or formatting changes, but also for bugs, right? Lots of foot guns abound. And if you can find where those are before you deploy them, you're going to be better off. There's also dynamic analyzers like Valgrind or Gprof, you know, profilers that run the code, and they leverage awareness of the program code, their code aware program analysis. And so they're using a lot of these metaprogramming techniques as well. Of course, you've got compilers and transpilers, which are basically, you know, convert program code to machine code or into a different flavor of program code. And then there's the, you know, JavaScript bundling, tree shaking, or maybe symbol stripping on the kind of more traditional binary world development where you take machine code and you modify it and transform it in some way, often, again, code aware. But you can use code modifiers and code transformers in many meaningful ways, kind of above and beyond these tools that already exist.
I do want to hit one particular word that you threw out there, but then didn't dig into. For those of us who maybe don't have English as their first language, you said foot guns abound.
Foot guns abound.
A foot gun is like, you know, nobody wants to shoot themselves in the foot, but if you give someone an amazingly powerful weapon and they point it in the wrong direction, they'll shoot themselves in the foot. So the short version of that is, you know, we added this feature to the product and now we've got another foot gun that's just ready to shoot everyone in the foot as opposed to doing the thing that it's supposed to do. Do you think sometimes that code generation can end up shooting people in the foot because they don't understand how it should fit into their ecosystem?
Oh, absolutely. But then you've got, you know, languages like C++ that are super, super powerful, you know, and there's lots of, you know, quote unquote rookie mistakes that you can be making. And in my opinion, you know, a lot of these are design decisions that kind of enable you to be more effective or at least be more granular or dig down deeper into the parts of the system that you do deal with, particularly around memory management, right? The more that you give developers tools to manage their own memory, unless there's good syntax and very legible and clear ways to manage those kind of memory, you know, issues, you end up with memory leaks. I don't think I've ever written a C++ program that doesn't have memory leaks in it.
I wonder what our C++ listeners are thinking, but the facts are the facts, right? That's a reasonable statement.
Yeah, I'll add C in there too. I think you know, memory managed languages also come with trade-offs. So I'm not suggesting that there's never a case for it. But I do think when you have a more powerful chainsaw, you need a more powerful chainsaw guide.
Yeah, and steel-toed boots.
And steel-toed boots, for sure.
Okay, so let's try to parse some of this, no pun intended, apart a little bit. You know, we write some source. We are trying to express our intent in the clearest way possible. We're trying to take, you know, human intent and put it into machine intent. And in the process, there's always mistakes. How do we make sure that a code generator, which accelerates the speed at which I can lay code down, doesn't accelerate the speed at which I make more bugs?
Well, I think that's a challenge, and I think that that's a challenge that's always true. Whatever kind of technique that you're using to be more efficient in any kind of developer productivity sense. And the answer is, of course, continuous integration and a solid testing library that really sets, almost think of them like regression tests, right? So if my test code has regression tests, I can, you know, do, you know, semantic no-op changes to the code as much as I want because, you know, like a format or something, and just land that PR with total confidence. But if I'm making semantic operational changes, right, with code transformers, you know, I need that testing library to say, okay, before the PR, the behavior was this way, and then after the change, after the PR, the behavior is the same, at least in the ways that the tests have covered.
Okay. So I'm hearing you say that there needs to be a real organizational maturity and good software engineering practices, because if I introduce a code generator into an immature organization, it's not going to solve the problems if I don't already have a good CI/CD in place.
Yeah. I mean, I think the test code, well, so let's take a step back. Program code and test code, in my mind, are basically the same thing written twice in two different ways, so that when you change one, you have to also change the other. If it affects the kind of thing, you know, if it affects the way the behavior works. And so if you're going to be taking code transformation tool to either your program code or your test code, you need to be able to create that kind of delineation so that you have the confidence that when you actually land the change, it only breaks what it only breaks what you want it to break.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. I like the way that you phrased that it's the same thing written twice. It is your intent and then your assertion that you intended what your intent, right? Your assertion of your own intent. Okay. So you work on a thing called Yelli Code, YELLICODE, as well as a number of other projects in this space. And Yelli Code is it a code generator? It's an extensible code generator.
Yeah, it's like a set of primitives, kind of a library tools that you can use to make your own code generators or to do any kind of metaprogramming. We use it for a really cool technique. So we have at OneSignal, we have a web SDK people can put on their website. But different people make the websites in different ways, right? Insert the script tag works really great for kind of traditional website builders. But if you're working on like an Angular code base or React code base, you might want kind of a plugin that feels more native, gives you a higher level point of integration. And so what we do is we use YeliCode, which is this amazing TypeScript-based library. They have lots of tools for C#, so you can do kind of code models in C# and set up an AST in different kinds of languages. So we use TypeScript. And so we use YeliCode to pull in TypeScript code, and we do metaprogramming based off of the objects. So we look at basically function signatures as objects, TypeScript function signatures as objects in code. And then we take, template files, Mustache or something like that, and we just output, specific kind of shims that are really glue code between our existing web SDK and, let's say, Angular or Vue or something like that. And then we can release that as a Vue-specific SDK. And the benefit of that is, as we change our web SDK, we don't have to change the three downstream kind of projects. We just run, the build step, and that propagates down into new SDKs. And the other benefit is we don't have to have four code bases. We have one.
So I want to tease apart a couple of things there to make sure that our folks that are maybe early in career who are listening mm-hmm. can follow along. You said AST, right? That's an abstract syntax tree. This is like I've heard the term code DOM, the document object model of the browser. Imagine if there was a DOM for your the expression of what you're trying to do. So we're not talking about parsing text, right? That's going to be hidden from us, and then it's going to express itself in a different format.
Yeah, the first step of any kind of compiler or tool is really to parse the text. And there's lots of different ways that you can parse text. And an AST, you can think about it as a data structure that holds code, right? Other kinds of data structures exist. So there's something called concrete syntax trees, which have a little more information around like the white space and maybe comments and things that are like text related that don't usually make it all the way down into machine code. Mm-hmm. And of course, you can also have text blobs, right? There's lots of different ways to kind of, model a text blob. And so you can have basically a string that's a very long piece of code, maybe even a whole file's worth of code. And so we have another tool, this might be interesting, that we were looking at injecting our SDK into mobile code bases. So if you have an Android code base, iOS code base, maybe React Native, something like that, we want to be able to say, hey, download our CLI, run our CLI, it will insert the SDK for you, set up all the code for you, set up all the infrastructure. And so we went through kind of an iterative development process when we first built this thing. So the prototype used a regex. It said, okay, pull in, if we have to modify this particular file, pull in that whole file into memory as a string, run this regular expression against it to swap out a couple of things, and then print it back out. And that regex approach works well, asterisk, for folks who've used regular expressions before. They know that it can be quite challenging, especially when dealing with something as syntactically complicated as code. And so then we looked at text markers as a kind of a next iterative approach of kind of being more thoughtful about how we manage the text. And so text markers, okay, rather than pulling the whole thing as a file, we chunk it up into words, quote unquote words, atoms, you might have heard them called in kind of compiler class for folks who have taken that. So we look at these atoms and we look for a specific atom and say, okay, insert between these two atoms our kind of invocation code. And that works well, but again, there's complexity there. So one example is, Kotlin and Java are kind of two flavors of the same thing, mm-hmm. on in kind of the Android world. And so we wanted to be able to manipulate more thoughtfully, especially when it comes to things like project settings in Xcode, for example, can be very challenging to manage. So we used an AST. An AST is an abstract syntax tree, and basically is a full-on data structure for a particular piece of code.
Okay, and then that point right there, to make sure that our friends who are listening carefully, it's a data structure that represents code. And that is the essence, right, of metaprogramming, right? Metaprogramming is programming in which a computer program gets to treat another computer program as data, as input, programs as input to other programs. And that's the essence of when we start getting into the ability to go and generate code, because you have the model, and then you have this template that represents a program with some inputs, some stuff I don't know, right? Some stuff I don't know yet. And it's that model, that input that gives me the thing that I need to know.
Yeah. Scott, you had sent me a blog post that you had written a while ago about a project you had worked on for kind of infra as code.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Infrastructure as code.
And lots of folks have used infra as code. Mm-hmm. Terraform kind of, there's others that come to mind. Kubernetes is kind of an inference code.
Pulumi.
And the nice thing about infra as code is, you know, the insight there is if you represent infra, your infrastructure as a data structure and then commit it, you can change and deal with kind of your code control process can apply to your infra kind of quote unquote code as well. You can think of ASTs as, you know, code as code, right? you can
that's pretty meta.
It's super meta. And that's why it's called metaprogramming, right?
Yeah, that's very interesting. The reason that we did that paper I sent you, I think was from 2007. And the idea was, the fundamental idea was a Word document can't break the build. So why are we expressing our intent in these Word documents? So what could we put, what format could we put our intent in? You know, a JSON file, a TypeScript file, a code somewhere, you know, the whole point is code breaks code. And like, can we get into that CI/CD like we talked about at the very, very beginning and put in some appropriate gates and some quality software engineering, because business people were checking in Word documents and nothing's breaking. The build still works, but it doesn't represent reality. And it seems like introducing code generation appropriately with good engineering practices solves a lot of those problems.
Absolutely. And it makes you more productive, right? It, you know, because part of being productive is not just how much time does this take me, but how likely is this operation going to result in more work for me because it broke something, right?
I love that. Yeah, that gets into, I had a TikTok recently about yak shaving. Some people know what yak shaving is and some people don't, but it's just all that stuff that you do around the actual writing of the code. And you go, yeah, can you go and get the website up? Sure, when I'm done shaving that yak, which seems unrelated. And sometimes when introducing code generation into your company, it's going to feel like yak shaving to some people. They're going to feel like, well, this is a bunch of infrastructure you're trying to do, and you have to invest in that. How do you introduce code generation into an organization and explain that to the powers that be, that this is an important thing that will make our lives better? You can't just do this in a day, right?
Definitely. And I think there's a lot of different techniques that you can kind of use code generation and code transformation for that have clear business cases. So thinking about a lift and shift kind of migration, we're moving from platform A to platform B, or maybe platform A version 2 to platform B version 3. Concretely, Python Future is a project that I've worked on. And Python Future is an open source project for folks who don't know. There was a big Python 2 to Python 3 migration a little while ago. And it was challenging. There was a lot of differences between Python 2 and Python 3. And the amount of uncertainty that you're kind of getting when you switch your deploy, your infra as code, right? You flip the version 2 to version 3 bit, you know, that's a hugely risky PR to change. And so what Python Future does is it lets you kind of granularly change Python 2 over to Python 3 by making Python 2 behave like Python 3, first of all, and then by transforming the existing Python 2 code in a way that is runnable under Python 2 or Python 3 the exact same way. And then that way, you know, when you actually flip the 2 to the 3, you're just changing the runtime, you're changing the virtual machine. You've already pulled in all those backwards incompatible features that are challenging or risky.
How much of that was or could have been done manually, you know, a layer between two worlds, a shim layer of some kind, versus how much of that was generated?
Yeah, I mean, I think so for Python Future, it's kind of a two-piece part. The first one is the set of transformers. And the second is there's a runtime shim. So you kind of, in Python, there's this concept called monkey patching, which is basically like you insert a code object into memory. So like you import, you know, a file from standard, you know, the standard library file package. Well, the standard library file package, I'm speaking purely hypothetically here, might be different between Python 2 and Python 3. So Python Future enables you to pull in the Python 3 file package into Python 2, but using the same API, using the same namespace. And so that way you can kind of be more granular, but there's a runtime kind of shim that changes the behavior at runtime. In this case, for Python Future, it's a mix of both. You have compile time code transformers, and then you have kind of runtime behavior bridges, if you will.
Mm-hmm. And in that, using that example of the big major version, the big Python 2 to Python 3 shift, there were other projects that were excited about making that easier. There's 2 to 3 and there's 6 and things like that. But they have kind of different philosophies than what you're doing. Like I have written converters very often time those kind of transformers, converters, transpilers, whatever you want to call it, are one way. And it's like, we did it and it either worked or it didn't. And then you clean up the downstream result. But it seems like Python Future has a slightly different philosophy.
Yeah, that's right. So 2 to 3, 6 in Future are definitely like the three big ways to do it. 2 to 3, I think, was the first one that the community came up with. And the idea was, okay, maybe you can just run a program that transforms your Python 2 code to Python 3 code. In practice, that turned out to not be easy. There's a long tail of weird little changes. And the bigger your code base is, the more you'll come across those. So there have been code bases that are fairly small that you could reasonably do a Python 2 to Python 3 migration on manually in a day or two. But I was working on this project at Pinterest, which had many hundreds of thousands of lines of code. And so that kind of lift and shift needed to be more strategic. So we looked at 6 and at Future. 6 is, probably from an engineering perspective, a more clean approach. You're not using monkey patching. You're not transforming code willy-nilly. But what you are doing is you have a lot of if blocks where you're saying, okay, if, my version is 2, then behave this way. And 6 gives you kind of a target to do that. So we thought about using 6 and we decided against it because essentially that, migration would require, instead of inserting, with Future, it's step one, run these transformers to make Python 2 code run like be 2 and 3 compatible. Step 2, run it on Python 3. And then step 3, remove all the, Python 2 specific languages or those runtime shims that are no longer necessary because they're basically no ops under Python 3. Mm-hmm. But with 6, your code base is now littered with, if version equals 2, do this. If version equals 3, do that. And then you have to go back in that third step and change them. So we were kind of thinking about what is the end-to-end life cycle of applying this? And they are different philosophies. And I think you could be effective using either one. But you have to think about what is the whole life cycle of this project going to look like? What is the developer pain that's going to be experienced when they have to write, if version equals 2, do this, if version equals 3, do that across the code base for what is essentially going to be months, right? Because there's going to, this is in a very large code base, a migration, a lift and shift like this. Everyone wants to think it takes, a month or two, but in reality, it takes a year or two.
Mm-hmm. This episode of Hansel Minutes is sponsored by Datadog. Now offering Cloud Security Posture Management, CPSM, Datadog provides one-click compliance posture. With Datadog security monitoring, engineering teams can easily detect malicious activity in real time before it affects their customers. Use out-of-the-box detection rules and detailed observability data in one unified platform to investigate potential security attacks. See it in action by signing up for a free trial and receive a Datadog t-shirt by visiting datadoghq.com/hanselminutes-security. That's datadoghq.com/hanselminutes-security. In the conversations that we're having here, I'm hearing generator, I'm hearing compiler, I'm hearing transpiler, I'm hearing transformer. I'm worried that maybe I'm misusing some of these words and that people who are listening might also feel like as they move around and they search for things that they don't understand some of these terms. Can we break down, like, for example, the difference between, let's just start with like a compiler versus a transpiler? We hear that term a lot.
Oh, yeah. So compilers convert program code into machine code. So, that's a huge part of any IDE, right? It compiles program code into machine code. GCC is the GNU compiler. Clang is another kind of compiler. LLVM is,
C Sharp turns into IL. It's right. Going lower level.
Lower level. Transpilers convert program code to program code. So one example would be kind of like TypeScript. Right, TypeScript is a program that converts TypeScript into JavaScript, and so in the end you end up with program code, but you're working with one kind of program code, and then you can think about code transformers as we're not changing the language that this is being written in, we're just changing the words being used to express it. Right, so you're converting TypeScript to TypeScript, but it's a different the code itself changes within that TypeScript language or environment.
Okay. So then if we apply that those definitions and some of the better understanding that we have to something like Python Futures, we're creating a couple of different things here. We're using a generator to do some things, but there's also a runtime shim layer. Is that a transpiler project, or what would you call that?
Ooh, I mean, I think it definitely does transpiling. I think to some extent, there's maybe a philosophical question of, is Python 2 and Python 3 the same language?
I think a lot of people would have a lot of strong feelings about that, depending on who you ask.
Oh, yeah. And so, I the lines definitely get blurred. And I think the more that you dig under the hood, if you've ever actually built a compiler, which is a really fun exercise, by the way, I never went to school. I don't have a formal education. But compiler classes are really big in kind of universities. And I wanted to take one myself just to kind of build that knowledge. And I had a really fun time kind of doing that. And what I learned was, you know, when you turn code into data, you can do all sorts of stuff with that data. And the lines between a compiler, like the magic, you know, that it feels like when you click that little build icon and you result in a binary that you can't really look at as easily, kind of becomes demystified.
That's a really great point. Just as like a side thing for us to mention here, a little sidecar. You're right. Like I went to community college and I didn't take a lot of advanced classes till later. So it sounds like you and I have kind of surprisingly similar backgrounds in that. Like I didn't go to a deep school and I didn't start digging into how these things work until later. But there's so many great resources online. Hanselman's episode 586. Thorsten Bell actually has a whole thing at interpreterbook.com where he teaches you how to make your own fully working interpreter written in Go for a pretend language. And when I went and took a compiler class, the teacher said, "Welcome to the class. Here's a language I made up." And then you go and make a compiler for that language. And then you get to learn about the differences between compilers and interpreters. And the way I look at it is it's like you've been driving an automatic shift car your whole life. And then now we're going to learn about gear shifts and stuff. And it doesn't mean that I'm going to drive stick for the rest of my life, but now I know that stick shift exists. And it just opens your eyes up and you start seeing things differently. And even though you might be doing text boxes over data in React for your day job, knowing what's deep, deep underneath that is really interesting, isn't it?
For sure. And if you're a professional driver, it doesn't matter if your day-to-day rig is an automatic, you know, you want to get better at your craft, you've got to learn how to drive a manual.
That's a great point. This is an opportunity for folks to get better at their craft. So then rather than just going and writing a compiler, I'm hearing you say that a good way to kind of get started is to start exploring generative programming and metaprogramming and getting involved and picking up something like YellowCode. Now, I understand, though, that YellowCode is implemented with TypeScript and Node, but it can do anything in any language, right?
Absolutely. And there are lots of tools like YellowCode, right? So YellowCode is just kind of a library for building your own generators. Okay. There are generators out there, like T4 is another one, right? It's a code transformer baked into Visual Studio, which is kind of amazing. There are plenty of tools out there that do code transformation that don't require that you roll yourself kind of new code.
Okay. And I understand also that once you've got like a rich model, a rich expression of something as data, like OpenAPI, like Swagger, like, you know, I call it, you know, WSDL for the young people, the web service description language, OpenAPI generator is another project that you're involved in that can generate whole APIs. You can generate entire SDKs from an OpenAPI spec.
That's right. So it's probably worth talking a little bit about IDLs first before we dig into that.
And sure.
IDLs are interface design language, which is essentially a language that you can use to describe the particular API. So protocol buffers for folks who've used that, gRPC, Thrift. There's also Avro. I think Apache has this thing called Aero.
Well, and then WSDL, WSDL for many, many years, and then IDL, interface description language from Calm almost 20 years ago. There are many, many ways to express. Here's the header files for the people, right? It's just kind of a shape the shape of the intent of something, but not actually its actual intent, just the header file.
That's right. And so there's this tool called Swagger, which is an IDL. It's been since renamed to OpenAPI, thankfully. I didn't like the Swagger name personally. But OpenAPI is an interface design language interface definition language for REST APIs. And so you basically have a concrete way to describe a REST API, if it's RESTful or, you know, fully REST. Either way, you can define your API in this particular structure. And the really cool thing is there's a whole ecosystem of tooling around what to do when you've done that. So you can have documents like API reference documents generated from that IDL. That's a huge, you know, to me, that's code generation for sure.
Oh, that's amazing. Being able to generate documentation, it's magical.
It's amazing. And there's also, Open API Generator, which is a tool that we use at OneSignal to produce API client libraries. So you pull, basically it's a Java code base. It pulls in your IDL. And then what it does is it has mustache templates for different languages. So let's say Ruby, Go, C#, Python, and it will just, replace with variables all the different parts of the code that are actually specific to your API so that you can expose your API, its functions, its product models in that language. And there's a lot of really cool things you can do with that above and beyond just giving it to your customers so they can use it. For example, you can take that product model that you've built out with your classes, maybe your bookstore, you have a book class, an author class, and so on. I can pull that into my own code base so that we have one consistent source of truth. We're always operating off the same model and we don't have drift between this project and this project have their own versions of the internal product model. We're making it consistent across the board, not just with our customers, but with our own code bases too.
That's really interesting. So there's the verb aspect of things, like here's the shape and a bunch of verbs you can call, a bunch of actions you can take, but then sharing models, how deep would you go? Data transfer objects, view models, like how far into your program could the open API specification and then the generated SDK go before you would say, all right, now we're going to have our own internal representation of this data?
Oh, yeah. And there's, Open API Generator kind of does all this for you. It also does documentation. There's another thing it does. There's a load testing library. So you can actually have it spit out configuration for that load tester. There's so many cool things. Actually, at OneSignal, I'm pleased to announce we'll be doing an ongoing contribution to the open source project starting today. I'm pleased to announce that.
Well, that's fantastic. Well, actually, folks can go and learn about Open API Generator. It's openapi-generator.tech. It's up on GitHub at GitHub/OpenAPI Tools. I'm going to include links in the show notes to all of those things. It's a really well-organized project. It can't be overstated, I think you would agree, how many different languages, how many different frameworks. Once you have a really great spec, version 2, version 3 of Open API, you can generate dozens of languages and server stubs and documentation in Markdown and HTML and the format you want. And then even some talk about GraphQL and JMeter and all kinds of things like you mentioned, you can generate as well.
Yeah, we talked a bit earlier about how do we prove out the business value of this technique, right? I mean, this is super easy. You have one code base, you have one source of truth, you can produce countless SDKs and client libraries, and when you have to go update them. So the maintenance cost of going in and updating them, if you hand roll your own, that maintenance cost is very high. If you have one source of truth, you've got one place to change, and you can update all your SDKs.
Okay, so let me ask, we're getting towards the end here, but let me ask a quote-unquote controversial question. There has been arguments that an SDK or a client SDK should be somewhat idiomatic. It should be specific. It should be like poetry, like written by a native. So if I generate a Ruby client for my API, it might not be as nice as if someone had written it themselves bespoke. You go and you get a bespoke suit as opposed to one off the rack. Yes or no? What do you think?
Oh, that's a tough debate. And it's one we had internally as well when we thought about this. And I think the answer is essentially that it's trade-offs, right? You can roll your own and you will come up with something super idiomatic, or you can use a tool like Open API Generator and what's going to get spit out isn't necessarily super idiomatic, but you do have ways to mitigate the costs on both of those ways, right? So if you were to roll your own, you can easily use your own code transformers to make maintenance costs simpler by modifying SDKs across all your code base, or you can use an off-the-shelf tool like Open API Generator. Yes, it's not going to spit out the most idiomatic code right away, but you can always change it. And guess what? Because it's open source, you can upstream your changes like we do and make it more idiomatic for everyone else. And that's, to me, a win-win-win.
Absolutely fantastic. Well, thank you so much, Jordan Adler, for chatting with me today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks, Scott.
We've been talking with Jordan. He's the head of developer engineering at OneSignal, and we're going to include links to OpenAPI Generator that we mentioned, YeliCode, Python Future, and lots more. This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.